Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Reggie Carpenter. Carpenter is a Parents' Choice Gold Award-winning storyteller and an educator. Since 1993, she has been featured in schools, festivals, museums, and libraries. Most recently, she received a very prestigious national award, the J.J. Renaud Award, for an emerging storyteller. Her work can be found on several CDs, including her most recent autobiographical work called Bendable Barbie. Welcome to the show.
No, thank you, Tish.
Now, I want to talk to you about this. More traditionally these days, people seem to choose writing memoirs or poetry or even art to express themselves.
Yeah.
Well, what attracted you to storytelling?
Well, I first got attracted to storytelling because I'd had my first son, and I really didn't know what to do anymore. I kind of had gotten lost. I remember going to a party someone asked me, so what kind of music do you like? And I couldn't tell them. And so I took a job with an arts organization because I'd always, you know, acted and done improv. And I literally was in the hall and fell into a performance. I mean, literally just fell into the hall. It was so embarrassing. And it was a storyteller, David Novak, was there, and I was completely enthralled. And while I was sitting there, I went, now that would really be something to do with your life. Mm-hmm. And I started working it. And I love to tell kids this story, that when I first went to do my first show where I got paid, I was so awful that they asked me not to do the second show.
Are you serious?
It's true. And at that point, I didn't realize that storytelling wasn't about words, that it was about pictures. So I really didn't know what I was doing. But by then, I had fallen in love, so I wanted to keep going. And so I just kept working at it.
This was a way to self-discovery in some ways.
Oh, yes, completely.
Uh-huh.
Completely. Yeah, the stories. There's a saying that says, you know, you don't find the story finds you. Mm-hmm. And when it's done with you, it will walk away.
Well, tell us about the process of developing a story.
Mm-hmm.
How do you begin? With a line or a thought? Tell us.
Well, it depends on what I like to do. Sometimes it's purely an exercise. Some stories I like to copy musical forms. Some stories I like to, they just kind of come to me. Some stories are dream stories. Some stories I need to do because I have a show that I'm getting paid for. So there's practical and whimsical reasons. But it's very much for me, it starts out with an image or a color or a desire to express an emotion, usually a dualistic emotion of like wonder and fear or something very, very, to me, which is very ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, that's where life is.
So a lot of your stuff is autobiographical. Mm-hmm. Have you found that a lot of that delving has been painful?
Oh, yes. But the process of telling a personal story is for the courageous.
Mm.
So to be courageous, one has to look at the whole picture. And also to be a good storyteller, you can't tell a story that's just about you. You have to tell a story that includes you and every other person. So finding the universal within the story is important. And also by the time you're telling the story, you have hopefully worked out all of that, the pain, and have found the larger story within your moment.
Mm-hmm. Now, is performing a story almost like finding a role? Is it like theater?
Oh, gosh. Thanks for asking that. No. I couldn't act my way out of a paper bag. No. Well, first of all, you know, when you're a megalomaniac like I am, you have to do all the roles, A. And secondly, no, it's very, you know, in theater, you're pretending that the people aren't there. And in stories, it's only alive because the people are there.
Mm.
So I'm telling half the story and you're hearing the other half. So it's also not so tightly scripted. You know, in theater, you're going to have an actor say one thing and an actor will respond.
Mm-hmm.
But I might respond in a completely different way given the response of the audience.
So in some ways, you're developing the story right there in front of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
I would never have thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
I would always assume this would be scripted.
Well,
I mean, tightly scripted.
Some tellers, yes. But mm-hmm. for me, most of it is scripted because by the time I get to the performance part, I have worked it pretty carefully. But there's always that 20% that I'm going to go, okay, where are we going to go? What's going to happen? What are we going to do?
Mm-hmm. And so you've put a lot of your stories on CD. Do you ever go back and say, oh, my gosh, I shouldn't have scripted it that way or put it out in public that way and want very much to change it?
Because no.
Because it's so different every time you do it, probably, in front of an audience.
I'll tell you a secret in front of, 50 million people. I don't listen to my CDs when I'm done.
Really?
I'm pretty done.
Really?
Yeah, in fact, this is really funny. I was listening. I had to listen to the master of a CD because, you have to approve the master. And I was in my car driving along, and the story came on, and I was really self-conscious. And then about a minute and a half into the story, I forgot it was me. And I'm listening, and at the end of the story, I had to pull over because I was like, oh, that was such a great story. Then I remembered it was mine. So it was pretty goofy. But I don't listen to my
Well,
pieces.
So you do sort of transport into another character,
yeah,
then, if you didn't
yeah.
even recognize yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that, that's so funny, isn't it?
That is. Now you studied music at Ithaca College.
Yes.
And you meld music
yes.
with a lot of your stories and on your CDs. Is that normal for a storyteller to meld music, or is that you because you were interested in music?
The beautiful thing about telling is it's really entirely unique depending on the teller's skills and inclinations. Mm-hmm. So many tellers do. I have a tendency to think of stories as music, so I kind of score them that way. I find the form. I like doing like Rhonda form, and I enjoy saying, I wonder if I could tell a recitative, or I really enjoy that. Right now, these pieces that I'm working on are like very much operas, mm-hmm. so finding the voice, the timbre, the rhythm, the tempo, everything within that. So that's my interest.
Mm-hmm. And why did you decide not to go into pure music after having studied it?
That is a great question. I left Ithaca College and didn't sing for 15 years.
May I ask why?
I just felt really, it was like the music just was squashed out of me. I just felt that, I think I went to the wrong music school. And Ithaca College is a great music school.
Yeah,
but
is.
For me, it wasn't quite right. And I just didn't have the wherewithal. I couldn't find my place there.
Hmm.
So,
and it obviously wasn't because you didn't like the structure, right? I mean, you do like structures.
I do. I don't know exactly what about it. I don't know if it was the time of my life or.
Mm-hmm. But music has helped you with this ensuing career that happened afterwards. Obviously,
definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You tell a lot of stories about your family,
mm-hmm.
and how does that work? Do you ask them whether you can reveal things? A lot of them are very personal revelations.
I tell all my personal stories to my family, and I'm the youngest in the family, so many of the memories that I have are not fully realized, so I have to ask my brothers and sisters, hey, do you remember this, or what do you know about that? And in interviewing them, I'm able to get a more full picture. And again, it's not just about my little story, but it's about my family story, which is an archetypal story,
mm-hmm.
So that's...
Well, how much of personal storytelling do you think does transfer into fiction? Especially when you know you're going to have an audience. Do people dramatize things for an audience?
Well, there's that saying that says, I never let the facts get in the way of the truth.
There is that saying. That's a political saying, I think.
So there are facts that I exaggerate, but I don't tell outright lies or anything like that. That would be unethical. But I will tell you that some of my family said, well, it didn't happen like that. And then they'll tell a completely different point of view. So from their point of view, my remembering is a fabrication.
Hmm.
So it's just memory is very interesting.
It is very interesting.
The creation of identity is such a mystery.
And so when you have passed this along to your family in regard to mm-hmm. what you're thinking and what your memories are, did you ever find yourself censoring yourself because of what they've said?
No. But I don't include anything that would be unkind, you know, or too private.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up in this all my brothers and sisters are amazing. We're all just fierce individuals. And, you know, when you grow up in a little town like mine, you just live in a goldfish bowl. So it's not like we haven't been exposed before this.
Mm-hmm. To tell us a little bit about where you grew up.
Oh, I grew up in the St. Lawrence River in this little town called Clayton, where my father came from, and his father and my great grandfather, and we settled there as part of the Catholics who came down from Canada.
Mm.
So our original name was Charpentier, and in Clayton there is an area called French Creek where the French Canadians settled and built a French community, built a Catholic church. And along that side of the river, there was boat builders, guides, people who lived on the river, worked the river. And so I'm a Frenchie.
Mm-hmm. And did you hear stories as a child?
Not one.
Not one?
No, my dad knew every dirty joke that could possibly. So those were, and he used to tell them to us, you know, when we were little, you know, we were sitting there going, huh, I wonder what that about. But my dad was laughing, so it seemed like a good idea. So the stories that my dad would tell were about the river, and they were really like, take us down to the water, and he would show us how to read the ripples, or he would show you how to read the waves, or the way that the color of the water was. He'd say, now you see that underneath that color, there's going to be a current, so don't go over there. And if you look at, see those little ripples over there, that's where the trout are, so that's where you want to fish. And he would just teach us that, or we'd look up at the sky, and he would say, you know, now this sky, we're going to have this kind of weather coming in. And so that's really the stories that he would tell us.
Mm-hmm. And did you get intrigued at all by stories and books when you were a child? You must have.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I didn't read until I was pretty old, like near eight. But we had this Children Childcraft series that my dad sold because he sold the Encyclopedia Britannica. So we had these. And I stayed home with my mom because I was the last of the five. And so I was home with my mom a lot and, you know, by myself. And I would just read these books and look at the pictures and tell stories. But there were always a lot of books at home.
Mm-hmm.
But we never were read to. We didn't really want to play with our parents.
Really? I would think you'd have to love books and literature to want to be a storyteller.
I think so.
Yeah. Now, do you think there's a fine line between confessional and therapeutic storytelling and really creating an art? Which I consider storytelling as.
It's not such a fine line. It's a pretty big chasm, actually. Mm. When you're with a storyteller who's doing therapeutic telling, it's painful because it's about them. And not that there's not room for that, but that's not the forum. The forum has to transcend the personal while it incorporates the personal. So if you're with a teller who's doing therapeutic telling, I find it actually quite painful, and I call those dog stories, you know. Let me tell you about my dog, and, you know, so there's a responsibility as a teller. If you're going to work your material, you need to include other people's experience, and the whole point of pain and doing with it with laughter is to find the compassion for others, you know, so that I'm helping you find that moment in your life, too.
Mm-hmm. So you're not really trying to make people uncomfortable, like some confessional poetry?
Oh, yeah, I am,
poetry.
Tish. I am really trying to make them
uncomfortable. Are you? Are you trying to make people
make them
think?
Bleed.
Are you?
No.
Well, one never knows.
Boils erupt out all over their skin.
but what about the fine between confessional, though, and really honing a universal story? Is there a fine line there, too?
Well, I don't know the answer to that.
Hmm. Hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Reggie Carpenter. She's a storyteller and an educator.
Thank you.
Now, I understand you want to read a story for us, so take the floor and let's hear it. Tell
okay.
us about it.
All right. Now, this story is called The Lucky Call. When the pains came upon her, she was standing in the hallway. She reached her hand down, and when she pulled it back up, it was red and wet. When her hand got curious again, she felt the cord protruding between her legs. Nobody's fool. She stood up all the way in the taxi on the way to the hospital. Life went right when it should have gone left. And that was one dead baby wearing a lucky call, the birth sheath, the skin that midwives open up and then save to give to sailors because they believe it'll save them from drowning. The lucky call is believed to be a veil between the invisible and the visible, and the baby that wears it has the ability to see spirits. Well, the prophecy came true. Because that baby was brought back to life and whisked away to an incubator. And the mother, who almost bled out for a child she didn't even know, she came back too. Life went right when it should have gone right. The baby lived and the mother lived. But they were separated for 3 days. The baby in the incubator, wondering if it had a mother, and the mother in her bed, wondering if she had a baby. They couldn't know it, but those questions would haunt those two for 50 years.
And that's true, huh? It haunted it you and your true. Mother for 50 years?
It is true. My mother and I never, we just never really connected until just recently.
And how did she react has she heard the story that you just
actually
recited?
Sure, she has. Yeah, definitely. I don't keep any secrets from my family, except the secrets we're all keeping. it's part of our myth. Actually the story goes far beyond that. Like, my mother was very ill, and all my brothers and sisters were sent into foster care when I was born, and then I was sent into foster care, and it took my mother a long time to recover, and then all the kids came back, and I came back about, 4 or 5 months later. So, the joke when I was growing up was, happy birthday, you almost killed Mom,
Oh, my goodness.
Which, is just like, I find it kind of funny, but it's also, that's just my family.
Uh-huh.
So...
Well, I think it's great that you have an outlet to be able to talk about this.
Yeah.
And in a beautiful way.
Well, thank
instead
you.
Of an accusatory way, as some people would.
Oh, yeah. No, that doesn't really interest me.
You know what I want to talk to you about? I want to talk to you about the fact that you teach storytelling.
Oh, yeah.
And you teach workshops.
Yeah.
Well, what do you emphasize to an aspiring storyteller? What's the most important thing for them to begin with?
The most important thing for them to begin with is unleashing their power of imagery. Because from the imagery, the voice responds, the language responds, the structure of the story responds. So when you're able to picture the story, then everything else becomes organic to the teller. So they are able to find their authentic voice, and they're able to find their rhythm, they're able to find their physicality. So that's an internal way that I like to work, and there are many, many ways to work, clearly, but that's for me, is for me to help you grow into yourself.
Mm-hmm. And you also emphasize movement.
I do.
In your storytelling workshops. That wouldn't be the first thing that I would think of in regard to storytelling. Talk to us about why movement is important.
Well, if you spend a lot of time with really little children, which are the children that I like to work with, the pre-literate children, movement always precedes language. Language is a secondary function. So if we are able to move through a story so that you're able to see the story structure, and through your body you're able to find the shape of the story, the sequence of events of the story, then you're going to be able to free yourself from the form of language and keep evolving as the body is moving through. So you may be telling the same story all the time, but you'll be able to find different words as you're going because you're relying on the sensations of the body to help you get through it.
So it stirs up some different energies.
It does, yeah. It frees you. It frees you from your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get locked down and you forget to keep looking for the surprise moment in the story. Because the point of the story is that you don't know the whole story either. You know, the teller doesn't know the whole story because I can come back to material that I told 10 years ago, which The Lucky Call is one of those stories, and it's completely different now because my point of view isn't the same. And that's because I let the story go somewhere else inside of me and then reshaped it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard you read the story on your CD, which mm-hmm. was a number of years ago that you recorded mm-hmm. that, I assume.
Yeah.
And when you read it here just now, you seem more detached from it.
Yeah. Well, I turned it into third person.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. Because it's when I first told that story, it was a single story, and now it's part of a four-part piece that I've been working on about my mother, about, the line I keep telling myself about it is, I used to be a motherless child, but then she grew on me.
You know? That's a great line.
And for so many years, I felt like a motherless child, just really left very alone. And now I don't. Mm-hmm. And so that material that I first told doesn't really suit me anymore.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to watch yourself evolve, probably.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I also want to ask you about voice.
Oh, yeah.
In regard to what you teach in workshops.
Yes.
That seems to be something that people forget about in many aspects of life. How do you emphasize voice as a storyteller?
Oh, voice is my favorite thing because even though I love movement and physicalization and stuff like that, you know, my favorite storyteller, who is Jackie Torrance, didn't move. She didn't move a bit. She was very large, and she just sat in her chair and told stories, and she had this amazing voice. So, you know, storytelling, face it, is a narrative art. So to forget the voice is the principal tool that a storyteller has. So there's a couple of ways I love to think about voice, and one is that the mechanism of the voice, you know, so one has to make sure you're riding on the breath and you have the phrasing. The phrasing has to serve, like, the technical requirements depending on how demanding the story is. And it also has to serve the timbre of the story. So you have to be able to manipulate the voice enough so that it stays healthy but is expressive. And then the other thing that's really extraordinary about the voice is that if you didn't understand English and I was telling you a story, you would still be able to maybe get that feeling of what the story was about, or you would have an impression of it. So the voice, and I'm pulling voice away from language, but the quality of the voice is like a can opener to the psyche. You know, because we all know if we are listening to somebody who talks like that, we just shut them out. My God, it's so horrible. You know, you don't want to listen to that. You
exactly.
Just, it's grating. So the voice has to, like, get in there like a little worm and keep working at your brain and opening up, opening up, opening up, opening up. So there are technical requirements, and then there's, like, this, you know, kind of psychological or mystical quality of the voice, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there are the really, really fun aspects of the voice, which have to do with just color and the depiction of the voice, that the quality the voice can give to the character. Mm. So the kind of character you're going to have, you know, like Br'er Rabbit is going to be, hi, how are you today? Nice day, huh? Look good. You know, that huckster, you know, uh-huh, or uh-huh. Br'er Fox is going to be,
Br'er Rabbit, I'm going to get you, and when I do, rabbits stew.
You know, not too bright, you know? And so there's all kinds of things that get to be played with. And the voice is tremendously responsive if it's riding on the breath and if it's connected to the column of creativity. The voice will respond. The mm-hmm. voice will just respond. Mm-hmm. So many people go into learning voice through a technical, you know, I must breathe, I must hold my chin, I must open up. And those things are really important. But they're easily solved when they're connected to the creative column.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention again that you just won a pretty prestigious national award,
yeah.
The J.J. Renault Award. To tell us what that meant to you and what it means to your career.
Oh, thank you. Oh, gosh. Well, I had been sent the application by a friend of mine, and he said, I really think you should apply for this. And Leanne Marvin, who had been on your show, she also said, I think you should do this. And so it's a national contest, and you have to send in recommendations. People have seen your work by other professional tellers. You have to send in a sample of your work, video. And so I had done, Leanne and I started the Storyteller Studio at CSMA, and I had done an evening of these pieces that I felt really good about. And so I thought, well, I'll send this in. And the panel secret. The day before I got the phone call, I thought, oh, man, I just really embarrassed myself in front of all those storytellers I really admire. And then I get the phone call from a woman who knew Leanne, and it was almost her birthday. And so I thought she was calling. Oh, she must be calling me to ask when Leanne's birthday is. So then she called and said that I had won. And it was
amazing.
It was amazing because it really...
That gives you national exposure.
Well, you know, it gives me a lot of things. It came with a money award, mm-hmm. which has allowed me to study with Lauren Neamey, whom I really admire. I've lived in little Ithaca for 30 years and haven't really ventured out into the big bad world all that much. So for me to win that national award is kind of stunning.
That is. We're almost out of time.
Oh, yes. Thanks.
Reggie, can you just talk just a little tiny bit about what you're working on now and what we can expect?
Oh,
the story's about your mother.
I am working on the story about my mother. From when I was 16, I had a nervous breakdown and went into a mental hospital, and my mom was going to pretty much just leave me there. And so the things that I'm working on now are reconciliation with my mother and also with myself, and seeing that... it really doesn't matter what people do. You really can just love them.
Mm-hmm.
You just love them. And that's the job.
Well, we will look forward to hearing
those.
Thank
you.
I thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
And we really do wish you well with this new award.
Oh, thank you.
I think you're on your way.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed being with you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.